This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When Bill Shutt writes a book, it tends to get messy, at least his nonfiction books. His first was called Dark Banquet, which dealt with vampire bats and other creatures who feed on blood. To follow that up, he wrote Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, which dealt with, well, I think you know what that dealt with. Now he is back with a volume that every living creature can identify with. It's called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. Bill Shutt is a zoologist, emeritus professor of biology at LIU Post, and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. I asked Dr. Shutt why he took on the heart.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been into bizarre things. I was the kid who had a monkey when I was growing up, and I spent a lot of time watching horror movies. And so when I went to graduate school, it probably took about 5 minutes for me to figure out that I wanted to work on vampire bats. From there, I just thought that there was a hole in the literature. On one side of it, you'd have, so if you're talking about blood feeding or later on cannibalism, and those were my two first nonfiction books, there was all the sensationalistic stuff out there. And then there were the academic works that there was nothing in the middle. And so I sort of fit into that niche where you take a topic like blood feeding in Dark Banquet or cannibalism in the book of the same name. And you explain it in a way that's entertaining. You don't use a lot of jargon and you do it in a way that is also educational. And that's what I did with my first two books. When it came time to write the third book, I had other ideas and I won't go into them because I may use them down the road. But my editor at Algonquin and my agent, Jillian McKenzie, had suggested that I look a little bit more mainstream for my next topic. And they made a couple of suggestions. And one of them was the heart. And you know, initially I thought, well, this has got to have been done. And when I looked at the material, you know, if you look at cannibalism, it really goes through the animal kingdom and then it moves into humans. And what I noticed with the heart was that there really weren't any books out there that were popular science books that did that, that looked at the evolution of the heart, that looked at the zoology of the heart, and then moved into what turned out to be this treasure trove of stories based on misinformation about the heart that we had, new techniques that are evolving, really strange situations in the animal kingdom. And so, you know, initially I didn't know if that was going to work or not, but, you know, once I started writing it, I found out that it was, you know, there was plenty to write about in the style that had worked for me, I guess, in the past. So that's how I got working on a book about the heart and circulatory system. There's a lot more than just the heart here.
Well, I'd like to go into some of the earliest scientists who looked at the heart. And I got to start with Galen, because as you said in the book, he worked at a Roman gladiator school. That's just too cool not to start with.
Yeah, Galen, our first century CE. He was born in 129 CE. So just to sort of put that into perspective, he was a Roman philosopher and physician, and he did work at a gladiator school and where he was a surgeon. So he got to see the body and its parts from up close. And the thing about Galen, and he shows up in all of my books, is because it's really impossible to understate the impact that he had for about 1500 years. Now, unfortunately, you know, the guy was, he was brilliant, but a lot of what he came up with turned out to be wrong. And so, for example, he had fallen back on this idea of the four humors, that these substances that were found in the body and that by balancing them, and one of them being blood, that would be the way to cure any disease, whether it was a mental affliction. You know, women were bled for menstruating. People who were drowned were bled, you know, and this was just, there was really nothing to that. But unfortunately, sort of make a long story short, he wrote a lot. And whether it was his associates or whether it was Galen, you know, there were like 3 million words of Galen's medical writings. After the fall of the Roman Empire, his works were not translated into Latin, which at the time was sort of the language of scholarship, but they were translated into Arabic by Syrian Christian scholars. And those Arabic translations were then translated into Latin. And we think that when those translations were finally made into Latin, they were built upon the sort of Christian leanings of the of the translators. And the church loved that. They wound up declaring Galen's work to be divinely inspired. And so for the next roughly 1500 years, medicine was really devastated. You know, instead of doing research, you would just follow the writings of Galen. And a lot of his stuff was just plain wrong for reasons like he couldn't really dissect human bodies. He was working as a surgeon at the Gladiator School, but his scientific findings were based on dissecting animals. And so he got a lot of it wrong.
And there was there was actually a ban back then on dissecting human cadavers, right?
Yeah, and a lot of that ban had to do with the Greek cultural traditions related to the fact that corpses were thought to be contaminating and polluting, and you had to go through this litany of exercises if you came into contact with a dead body. And then also the Greeks had this negative connotation related to cutting human skin. You were to keep the body whole, you weren't to cut it up. So that really put the kibosh on human anatomical dissections for a long time.
Is Galen and his writings part of the reason that we romanticize the heart so much? You know, try to get somebody, win your heart or get their hearts and minds.
No, I don't see the Galen connection there. I see the Galen connection as far as the problems that we ran into with stagnation in the field of medicine. But the hearts and minds and romanticizing the heart, I think you have to go back to the ancient Egyptians who preserved the heart, and they either put it back in the body or they put it into bottles. And this was because the ancient Egyptians believed that the heart after death would be weighed against the feather of Mat. And this was an Egyptian goddess of truth and justice. And she would then decide if the owner had lived a virtuous life. So the emphasis by the Egyptian physicians was one that was cardiocentric. You know, everything was based on the heart, and they didn't really think much of the brain. We know that because they would, you know, they'd yank the brain out of a dead person through their nose and just get rid of it. But the heart was treated very differently. Now, Egyptian medicine was held in high esteem by the ancient Greeks, as was this idea that the heart was an organ that was the organ associated with the soul. So once that information was accepted by the Greeks, then the Greek philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, you know, they're the ones who came out and said that this is the seat, the heart is the seat of intelligence, the soul and emotions, and within those emotions, including love. That was passed on to the Romans. They added their own twists. One of my favorites is the vena amoris, which is a non-existent blood vessel that supposedly runs from the fourth finger of the left hand to the heart. Centuries later, that became the finger that you would put the wedding ring on. So once the Romans and once the Greeks, and then once you get into the Middle Ages, there's an explosion of art and literature and poetry that further cements the heart as the seat of emotion, especially emotions of a romantic nature. Yeah, so, and I think it's pretty much the same with this idea of hearts and minds. It's essentially the same story. When you look at the relationship between hearts and minds now, though, you do see that there's some science there, like the connections between our so-called spiritual lives and things like heart health, you know, yoga, meditation to ward off stress and things like that. But I wouldn't blame Galen. I think it goes back to the ancient Egyptians. They looked at this organ and said, you know, it moves, it's centrally located, it can be stimulated to move faster. So they really thought that this was the center of all things.
In my lifetime, I can think of three big mainstream news stories about the heart. That would be the first transplant, the artificial heart, and the baboon transplant into Baby Faye. Baby Faye makes the best story, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it is, you know, now that I've finished this book and gone through the edits and everything else, that's the story that just keeps coming back to me. And of course, I'd heard of it. It got widespread media coverage back in 1984 when the surgery took place. But when you mention it to people, they, you know, they have this vague notion of what took place. And they may mention that there was a baboon heart transplanted into a baby and that the baby wound up dying. But the, to me, the story was so much deeper than that. And the ramifications of that surgery just turned out to be tremendous, you know, almost like the opposite of Galen, you know, where Galen, there was this 1500 years of stagnation. Once, after the baby Faye surgery, there was an explosion in research related to fetal transplants and dealing with fetal diseases, and excuse me, newborn neonatal diseases and neonatal transplants.
Is heart transplantation now sort of a routine operation?
Well, it got to be, you know, initially, like, you know, I think the first transplant was in 1967, very famous case. And then the first artificial heart was 1982. You know, in 1984, when baby Faye's heart was transplanted, they'd never done transplants on an infant before, mainly because there was no way to get neonatal hearts. And so babies would, you know, that had certain conditions, like the condition that baby Faye had, were doomed. And so this was a big thing, you know, back then. And it turned out that it failed, but not for reasons that they thought it might fail. The baboon's heart was not rejected. The fact that the baboon had a different blood type than baby Faye, that turned out to be the reason that baby Faye's body had an autoimmune response, just like if you gave the wrong type of blood to somebody. So that's really what wound up happening. But after that, then transplants got back into the media again, and a lot more work got done on them. And as a matter of fact, Leonard Bailey, who did the transplant on baby Faye, wound up doing 200 heart transplants after that. So I don't know if it became, you know, something that was, you know, a run of the mill type of surgery. It was never that, but it certainly, we learned a whole lot more about it after the baby Faye story.
Still to come, our conversation with Bill Shutt continues with that age-old question, does size really matter? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Bill Shutt, author of the new book called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. Earlier, Dr. Shutt spoke about how difficult it was to obtain a donor heart small enough for an infant. So I asked if the size of hearts across the board stays proportional to the size of the creature they're pumping blood through.
That's kind of interesting because my friends up at the Royal Ontario Museum who wound up recovering and then over a 5-year period, having this blue whale heart preserved, which turned out to be the prologue in the first chapter of Pump. You know, they were expecting a heart that was going to be a lot bigger. And one of my friends, a curator friend, you know, he'd been asked all sorts of many times, how big is the blue whale heart? How big is the largest heart? And he would say, you know, it's as big as a sedan. But they didn't know until they got this opportunity to recover this whale heart. And this whale had been stranded and wound up washing up dead in Canada. And what they found out was that it was a lot smaller ultimately than they thought it would be. And that sort of makes sense now that you look in at the size of that heart and compare it to other hearts. So for example, that blue whale heart, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to downplay the size because the thing is 42 inches high and 38 inches across. If you look at it compared to the size of the body, to the weight of the animal, it's 0.3% of the blue whale's total body weight. And that is a lot smaller than, say, for example, if you were to look at the other extreme, a hummingbird heart, a hummingbird's weigh about 22 grams or so. But a hummingbird's heart weighs about 2.4% of the body of its body weight. So it's a whole lot bigger relative to the size of the animal than the blue whale heart. And we think that this has a lot to do with the hyperactive lifestyle that hummingbirds have. And so what happens there is that they need more energy. And the only way to get more energy and more oxygen is to get blood to those muscles. So the way that you can get more blood to a muscle is either to speed up the heart rate. And I think that at 1300 beats per minute, the hummingbird heart rate is maxed out. I don't think that a vertebrate heart can beat much faster than that. But the other way to get more blood to, say, flight muscles is to increase the size of the heart so that every time the heart pumps, it pumps out more blood. So that's what I think you're seeing here. So that animals that have a higher metabolic rate, like hummingbirds or shrews, they're going to have a relatively larger heart than something like a blue whale that can slow its heart rate down to 2 beats per minute.
How important is it, actually, to listen to the heart? Every medical professional has got its stethoscope, and they're always just sticking that on your chest. Are they really listening for something?
Yeah, I think that stethoscopes give physicians another measurement, like pulse rate, that can be compared to a generalized normal reading, and it adds an important diagnostic tool to what you can do in a pinch. And I went back and looked at the development. The first stethoscope, how did that come about? And that turned out to be a really fascinating story with this French physician in 1816 who lived in Paris, and they were dealing with this massive outbreak of what they were calling consumption at the time, and what was later characterized as tuberculosis, which is caused by this bacterium. Back then, the way that you can determine if consumption was taking place was to listen to body sounds. And you would tap on someone's chest and you would listen to the sound that came back. And this originated from a German whose father was tapping on wine barrels to determine how much wine was in those barrels. And they adopted that technique to detect abnormal amounts of liquid in the lungs, for example. And the second way that you could diagnose consumption would be with something called immediate auscultation, which is really listening to heart sounds by putting your ear up against someone's chest. Now, in the 19th century, there were issues with that, like people didn't bathe, they had lice. It was kind of an uncouth move to put your head on a woman's breast and try to listen to her heart sounds. And what Laennec developed was a way to do that without coming into contact with his patient. And it turned into the stethoscope.
So you wrote about Galen and what he thought he knew and he really didn't. What do we still not know about the heart, or do we think we don't know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'll give you an example. When a coronary artery, and we've got these four coronary arteries that supply the heart muscle, when they're blocked, the tissue that is downstream of that blockage becomes starved. And eventually, if it doesn't get oxygen and nutrients because the blood flow is cut off, that tissue can die. And the tissue that we're talking about here is cardiac muscle. And those cardiac muscle cells, mostly called fibers, not cells, they're able to contract. And that contraction, when you talk about thousands and thousands and thousands of cells, turns the heart in. It's really what turns the heart into this pump. The problem is that if the tissue downstream of the blockage, if those cells die, then even if you restore the flow to that area, so let's say you take care of the blockage, you put a stent in, those cells in that tissue do not regrow into contractile cells. In a sense, they come back as scar tissue. So it's a little bit like if you had a mechanical pump and parts of it were faulty and you replaced them with parts that didn't work. So, you know, that's why people think sometimes describe heart attacks as, you know, people who die of a heart attack, sometimes they don't die all at once, they die in stages. And it's the fact that different parts of the heart are just not functional as a pump. That we still don't know how to regenerate functional cardiac muscle tissue. But as you can imagine, there's a tremendous amount of work being done on it. Things like taking stem cells and converting those stem cells into cardiac muscle cells, which can be done, and then trying to take those cardiac muscle cells and put them back into the heart. So there are all sorts of ways, techniques that are now being worked on by researchers all over the world to try to cope with the fact that, you know, the results of a heart attack are oftentimes can't be reversed.
So look ahead. What is the future of our hearts? Are we one of these days just going to have them replaced with something that was 3D printed?
Yeah, that's one. I mean, there's a researcher in Israel who's working on a 3D printed heart. But I also worked with and interviewed, not worked with, a researcher by the name of Dr. Ott at Harvard, who's in a sense trying to grow, you know, try to grow your own heart. A lot of people die on waiting lists, waiting for a transplant, because you have to have the right blood type, tissue type has to match, that sort of thing. And it's not just hearts, it's other organs as well. So what they're trying to do is to take cadaver hearts, which are easier to come by, and strip away all of the tissue, all of the cells that your body would have an immune response to if you were to take that cadaver heart and try to put it into, you know, into a recipient. And then take that framework that's left, and it's a connective tissue framework, mostly collagen, which is the most common connective tissue in our body, and take that framework, that scaffold, and to seed it with cardiac muscle cells that were generated from that patient, from that recipient. You take cells from his skin and then convert those stem cells into muscle cells, and then in a sense seed this structure, grow the cells on the scaffold, and then transplant that heart into the recipient. So that's the type of thing that's being done now. And you know, I knew nothing about this, and there was some other almost cooler types of research that were being done with things like doing similar things with replacing blood vessels. Say, you know, if you're going to regenerate the heart, then how do you deal with the fact that there are blood vessels that supply the heart? You know, there's a researcher that I interviewed by the name of Dr. Gaudet, who was taking spinach leaves, and you know they have veins, and doing really the same thing, stripping away the cells, but leaving the framework of the vein in the spinach leaf behind, and then seeding that framework with vascular cells that make up blood vessels. And then with the idea that you could transplant those onto this heart that was either computer printed or regenerated by the methods that Dr. Ott is working on. So there's a lot of really neat stuff going on here.
Again, the name of Bill Shutt's book is Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. You can learn more at billshutt.com. That's spelled S-C-H-U-T-T. We've spent an awful lot of time talking about the heart today. Let's move up about a foot and a half and spend some time with the brain. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What if you could control something by just thinking? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Bin He, professor of biomedical engineering, explains.
Mind control is no longer science fiction. A brain-computer interface, or BCI, is a device that allows an individual to control a machine or computer just by thinking about it. Non-invasive EEG-based BCI use a brain wave or EEG to record and decode brain intention that is safe and convenient, compared to more risky, invasive methods that use a brain implant. Generally, they take longer to learn, and users ultimately vary in performance. We have looked into mind control by examining the brain side story and hypothesized that meditation or yoga is able to enhance and improve an individual's ability to control a BCI. We recently completed a large-scale human study involving an 8-week course in simple, widely practiced meditation techniques. to test their effect as a potential training tool for BCI control. Our results show that humans with just 8 weeks of lessons in mindful meditation training demonstrate significant advantage compared to those with no prior meditation training. The meditation group performed much better than the control group and learned the mind control skills much faster than the control group. Meditation has been widely practiced for well-being and improving health. Our work demonstrates that it can also enhance a person's mental power for mental control, and ultimately may facilitate broader use of non-invasive brain-computer interface technology.
That was Bin He of Carnegie Mellon University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.